This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American radio program. On today's show, you'll hear comedian Bartender Thurston discuss technology, race, and politics, and Arizona State Professor Melina Lim on how minority youth voices are using social media to organize. First up, we'll hear the race monologues of six Lewis and Clark students, Camille Christie, Raymond Fenton, Jasmine Grays, David Jenkins, Guadalupe Triana, and Tony Zamora.
My name is Andrew Yeh, and thank you for listening to APA Compass. Every year, students at Lewis and Clark College in Portland organize the Ray Warren Multicultural Symposium. The highlight is the standing room only live performance of the race monologues, during which students share their personal experiences with race, ethnicity, and identity. Six students share their monologues with us on today's show. We start with Guadalupe Triana, and Tony Zamora.
Tony Zamora.
Who provide loving tributes to their parents and grandparents for working so hard to provide opportunities for their children.
It was not until recently that I began feeling the sting of being labeled a minority in current society. It also was not too long ago when I realized that the term comes accompanied with a negative connotation. However, the last thing I want for someone to feel when I talk about who I am is pity. I tend to look at pity as a feeling humans feel towards something embarrassing, and my current reality should not cause anyone to feel sorry for me. I never want people to feel sorry or apologize for who or what I am, because I certainly don't feel the need to. Even now, as race plays a predominant role in our everyday lives, still, we all seem to hold these preconceived notions about each other, including me about you and you about me, but that's not where the discussion should stop. I'm Hispanic, I'm Mexican-American, I'm Mexican and I'm American, I'm both. As defined by our society, I'm privileged and restricted. Of that, I am thoroughly aware. Although belonging to two cultures may not be seen as an advantage in the U.S. currently, I definitely am aware that culturally and economically in the future, I'll be a f***ing winner. I belong to two cultures, but at the same time, I'm involved in the creation and shaping of a new one. Even now, as I talk about it, I'm certain that racial definitions have not only become confusing, but very obscure, abstract, and complex. I'm very aware not everyone's life is ideal, but this is why we all need to understand our individual situations in order to get the bigger picture. To begin with, my mom makes a living as a housekeeper, and my dad does so by waiting tables. Both work for a money-sucking grand hotel corporation. I see them come home with back-breaking stories about how their slightly above-average paying job is not fair to its employees, and yet somehow I can still afford to attend Lewis and Clark College. With this in mind, the idea that I'm attending a private liberal arts college about 2,079 miles away from home is astounding. Considering that a few months back, my parents advised me that I should perhaps put college off for a while so that I could focus on finding a steady job and attend college at a later time instead. With this in mind, and with the idea that this moment is about sharing personal details regarding my race and identity, here are three things that I want to kind of explain and talk about. I want to tell three different audiences about how racial aspects of my life are constantly on my mind. There's one message for the school and its population, a message to the cute boy on the other side of my dorm, I hope he isn't here, and one to my outstanding parents. All three of these things represent important parts of who I was, who I am, and who I will be in life. 1. Lewis and Clark College. Sometimes I cannot tell if we've clicked or not. I really cannot tell if I was prepared to come to school here or if you were even prepared to have me. Before coming here, I had an idea of what I was getting myself into. However, when I arrived, there was still the sense of culture shock that all these different people had warned me about. That's aside from my main point, though. I just wanted to let you know that I am here and I want to be friends with most of you. I promise I'm interesting and engaging, and although I may not have something necessarily groundbreaking to say about f***ing Plato, I still have an awesome background to share with you. It just takes time for you to understand me and for me to understand you. No two people are the same, so talk to me. And even if sometimes I feel as if I don't match and I don't fit in, I'm staying here for a while, and we can make it work. I promise. Now, moving on to the boy with the curly hair and the soft blue lazy eyes in my dorm. First, don't raise your hand if you're here, and don't become uncomfortable. Sometimes I can't tell if you're driven away by my awful sense of humor or something else. Perhaps they're just my feelings of insecurity blanketed by something else. Regardless, you seemed so disinterested when I casually chatted with your friend about my heritage and how little I knew of it, and that somehow made me less interesting. This may have not been a big deal to you, but these things always play out differently in my mind. I know you come from a completely different background than I do, but that doesn't take away from the fact that I think we'd have a great time talking about white people and indie music. In the end, I know my feelings of insecurity and uncertainty surrounding my ethnicity should not be a problem, but they are, and they're there. Finally, to my parents, ustedes son mi inspiración. Thank you for everything. Thank you for doing everything you could to ensure you'd have a better life. I know you don't know what the hell a monologue is, but that isn't your fault. Life is funny that way. I know it sounds strange, but thank you for crossing the border and coming to Los Estados Unidos. Thank you for raising me to be confident and allowing me to have the childish dreams I have always had and continue to have to this day. I feel that you guys raised me to be just as productive as any other person in the community. Thank you again for telling me the stories about how many nights you spent crammed in the back of a van to come here so that I could further understand the privilege of me being American. Thanks for all and everything you do.
My race monologue is titled The Seed. In the early 1940s, my grandfather came to the United States legally with the Braceros program, which allowed Mexicans to work in America with a permit. For several years, my grandfather worked hard, doing backbreaking labor that nobody else was willing to do. He was an ambitious man who had a vision for his family and planted a seed for his family in the United States. With that seed he planted, it has grown to be like a sequoia tree, and it has laid the foundation for everyone in my family to do something with their lives. Both of my parents have worked in the fields for over 30 years. Both my sister and I are receiving a college education thanks to my grandfather. Let's put all that aside for now, and let me ask you all a question. What comes to your mind when the word Mexican is brought up? Field worker, house cleaner, yard worker, illegal immigrant, clean ladies from Lewis and Clark, wetback, or person standing outside of Home Depot? Those are all things that probably ran through your head when you see the word or hear the word mentioned. As a child, I saw my mom and dad for 3 hours a day because they were out in the fields working to provide for my sister and me from 4 a.m. to 7 p.m., 6 days a week. Would you take that job? I didn't think so. Whoever we are, we come from somewhere and someone before has planted the seed of whom we've become, and that is the source of my Mexican pride. I myself, Anthony Ramos Zamora, am a proud Mexican who has been stereotyped with some of the things that I already mentioned above. Cesar Chavez taught all us Hispanics, si se puede, meaning yes we can. I can remember coming home as a child in tears from being bullied because I was called brown boy and being asked for my green card. I had many dark days as a child, not only because of the color of my skin was brown, but also because my parents picked lettuce and everyone knew. Why does that make me different, I asked myself every day when I cried in bed asking, why do they torment me? When I sought advice from my grandfather, who worked alongside Cesar Chavez, all he said to me was three words, and those three words have been my inspiration till this day. Si se puede. There are three words that are so powerful and have helped pave the way for my people. Those three words have planted a seed for the future generations of Hispanics. We all grow from a seed those before us planted, and it is what we do with it that's important. What employment we have does not matter. The color of our skin does not matter. But most importantly, what does matter is our ethnicity, which is a source of justified pride. I would like to end my monologue with a poem that I wrote titled Mexican Soldier to honor my grandfather. Worked in the fields day and night, with his family on his mind, he knew he had to stay on his grind. My grandfather migrated to the land of the free and home of the brave in search of a better life. The scorching sun did not faze him because he was a warrior with Aztec roots. This man showed no weakness, always up, never down, with no sign of a frown. A Mexican soldier fighting to open a new door for his family.
The next two students, J. Jasmine Grays, and Raymond Fenton, speak about labels, those which they receive and those which they claim. Sensitive listeners should understand that these monologues are about racial labels, and some labels may be offensive to some people.
I'm a collector. As a kid, I collected buttons, shells, and the rare foreign coin. As a newly minted adult, I collect labels. I live in California, so I automatically pass go and collect the surfer label. I've never surfed in my life. I wear glasses, so I graduated high school with a must-be-smart label. I don't mind these. They are grievances against my individuality, yes, but they are minor ones. People label each other because it makes life easier. Categories and labels and tables are easier to read than blocks of text. And yet, for all of these labels slapped onto my back when I wasn't looking, there are a few I feel almost affronted for not being able to be fully categorized. The parts of me that matter do not exist in the eyes of some. I have been mislabeled and no one seems inclined to fix it. So really, if I'm already hip deep in this label culture, what's a few more? I peel off a label halfway and peer underneath. Beneath a sticky residue is skin, tanned from a life underneath the Californian sun. It is a color I'm proud of, and I've undoubtedly inherited it from my mother. My father has a perpetually red nose and pale upper arms, and when he burns, he peels. My mother has a smooth, golden skin and no tan lines to speak of, and never burns but always tans. When I was born, I was white on the outside. Slowly, as I grew older and taller, my skin began to burn. My shoulders were a mess of sensitive red and peeling skin, and I was evolving. Because when I shed my old white skin, I began anew. My skin became tan. My skin is a graft of my mother's and father's. I am literally the product of an Asian woman and a Caucasian man. I am Asian. I am Caucasian. I am both and neither, and altogether I am confused. It would be a misrepresentation of my person if one was to call me Asian. In the same fashion, I cannot comfortably call myself Caucasian. My identity is often at odds with my appearance. My insides are not color-coded to match my outsides. Where do I stand as a girl with skin that burns and peels away to reveal a different color? So here I am. I am in the perpetual stage of not quite. I am in the land of in-between, where everything is similar and yet not. I am an Asian girl with a semi-Jewish nose, and I am a white girl with dark eyes and dark hair and tan skin. I am the puzzle piece that doesn't fit quite right. I am Jasmine, a girl who doesn't fit into either. I am inexplicable. I am uncategorical. I have no label on my forehead clearly delineating who I am. Who am I? I am scrabbling for an answer, piecing together an identity out of various scraps. These edges don't blend together, don't gradually melt from one color to another. They are sewn together and that's it. But it can't be, because I'm not a modern-day creation of Frankenstein, a body strung together with various parts. I'm one whole person. I do not have two girls inside of me, climbing on top of each other to see the outside world through my eyes. I'm not one or the other, I'm both. Sometimes, I feel entitled to switch our ethnicities like outfits. In a room within my mind, there is a closet, and I am standing in it, and wondering what I should wear for the next day. Like, hey, going to Chinatown today, better put the Chinese on. Like, it's something I can take on and off, a shirt that I don't feel like wearing on a particular day. Sometimes, I forget that I am American. An American looks like everyone. An American looks like you, looks like me. There are no set requirements on how an American should look. And yet, here I am, trying to look as Chinese as I can or as Caucasian as I can, like it makes me special. I forget that I'm already special, that I am a f***ing snowflake. I'm special because I'm a badass blend of bothness. But I forget. And so I thump at my chest and proclaim my unique ethnic cocktail, also that somebody remembers. Maybe somebody will remember. So far nobody does, because I'm still missing my goddamn label. Perhaps I cannot be labeled. Perhaps by labeling myself as multiracial, multi-categorical, I am displacing the idea of categories. And maybe, if humans drop certain social institutions like this, flung it from their bodies, stomped on it, ground it into the dirt, and set it on fire, the world may very well implode. Because what are we if not our labels?
I'm sitting here nervous because somehow I know that after this stone is thrown, I might get one back, causing more damage than what was ever first dealt. Because I felt the eyes in the back of my head, even just for a split second when she said, "nigger," or "my niggas." I don't know what it means to feel the pang of racial prejudice on my back, to sit in the eyes of my wife, on the faces of my children, and my wife's semi-privileged bastard. So why do I get the glances that shout sympathy to me from the top of your eyelids for a reality that was never mine? Already a mask of red floods your faces, or perhaps your temperature rises at the absurdity of my accounts of how I've been looked at. It's petty, right? I'm digging for something, right? Well, the only thing I'm digging for, no, not gold or sugar cane, is an answer that justifies why I'm being treated like I was the one who your great-great-great-great-granddaddy bought off the docks of Alabama or lost in a game of hold'em poker with his neighbor, because I was the most valuable thing of little worth that you could risk losing without feeling too much guilt when explaining why he gambled off her best boy to the missus. I'm not that nigger. I'm the nigger that has seen another nigger, in whatever proportions, elected as president of one of the greatest nations in the world. I'm the nigger that dares to say that I strive for a post-racial existence. I'm the nigger that is, like most of you, privileged enough to attend a stellar liberal arts college in perhaps the whitest city in America. I'm the nigger, to some degree, who is being broadcast in the lyrics of hip-hop and rap artists. I'm the 20th century nigger, and I'm hella proud of it. So the next time you find it pertinent to use the word nigger, use it with the knowledge that this nigger and that nigger and all of my niggers have come a far way, and like before, you should not be timid in pronouncing that.
What were some of the reactions you got after performing your piece?
Surprisingly, a lot of people, especially, well, particularly those of the Caucasian race, were really glad that I was bold enough to say something like this, because I believe that the idea or the conception of what the word nigger stands for is being taken out of context, because there are no niggers that have been whipped or have been lynched that are still alive today. There are different sort of niggers who have experienced institutionalized racism, or in some sort of institutionalized slavery of the mind, perhaps. So I believe that no one should be, afraid of using the word, because it doesn't bring the same connotations that it brought back then. We're in two different time. We're in a different century altogether.
Our final two students, Camille Christie and David Jenkins, both understand that one's racial identity is far more ambiguous than the color of one's skin.
I am white. There, I said it. You were looking at me, and that is what you were seeing. Light skin, blue eyes, and blonde hair. Some of you are probably wondering what I am doing up here right now. Well, I am here to tell you that white is a race. I am here to tell you that white is a race because I do not want whiteness to remain invisible. Because in this invisibility is immense power. What do I mean by invisibility? I am talking about the whiteness that goes unseen because it surrounds us every day. It is normalized to the point of invisibility. It becomes a concealed standard that is nearly impossible to measure up to, or to measure. This frightens me. It frightens me because unless we acknowledge whiteness, we cannot begin to deconstruct and move past its privilege. So, I am sitting here because I want you to see the color of my skin. I want you to see it, to acknowledge it, and then I want you to look past it. I want you to look past it and see more. I want you to see me. But most importantly, I want you to see the people that have shaped me. I want you to see my Nana. All 5 feet of her, who fed me cheese quesadillas until I could no longer move, who let me watch 3 movies instead of just the one that my mom allowed, who insisted upon blue sparkly dress for my quinceañera instead of the jeans and the shirt I was so used to, who has only recently, at the age of 40, started to drink tequila, because, as she tells me, estoy tan vieja, quiero tomar alcohol antes de morir. In other words, she wants to drink tequila before she dies. I want you to see me as a kid, knowing Disney movies only in Spanish and being bewildered upon learning that Bambi says bird instead of pájaro. I want you to see my love for her and her family. how my Spanish is unlike any other because it was shaped just by her. We have our own language, her English and my Spanish, combining to form a rather ridiculous but always loving dialogue. I want you to see my mom, with her crazy curly hair that she puts in a shower cap when I roll down the windows in our car. Our own unique compromise reached over thousands of miles and hours of road tripping. Raised in Nigeria, the first female surgeon in Napa County, who brandishes her machete with unparalleled skill, who did not need a partner to raise a child, and perhaps most importantly, who can wear men's superhero boxers with her swimsuit and pull it off. I want you to see the men who turned everything inside out, their gentleness, humor, and love. I want you to see Manny, who radiates warmth as if he were his own celestial body. Alex, who speaks four languages and whose competitive spirit drove me to spend hours in the library researching Japanese prisons. William, who said the first thing he wanted to do when he got out of prison was take a long bubble bath. Their story has touched me. Their jokes and over-the-top acting made me laugh in a place filled with so much sadness. Their experiences angered and frightened me. Before I met them, I did not know it was possible to feel so much hopelessness and hope at the same time. I know now and will carry their love and the knowledge they shared with me wherever I go. Now I am less frightened. Now I am hopeful because you know something about me. I want you to see these people who have shaped me. I want you to see them because only then can you begin to understand who I might be to you and who you might be to me.
I am someone who is not who I am due to my appearance. My identity is much more than just the way that I am seen. As the old adage goes, you cannot judge a book by its cover. Let me reveal to you a little more of the story that is contained within the pages of my book. I am a mixture of many things. I am the mixture of Latino, Cherokee, British Isles, and others. But because of my light skin complexion, I am simply white to anyone who does not know me well. But I want for you to know me. Let me tell you of who I am. For the majority of my upbringing, I was led to believe that I just belonged to the Latino, Cherokee, and British Isles races. Oh, and was I, as I still am today, so proud to come from such a variety of places. Then in eighth grade, I had to do a family history project, in which we had to trace back as far as we could our family trees. I first interviewed my Nana, my grandmother on my mom's side. What she told me changed my view of who I was forever. She told me that she had been a product of a rape, and that her father was never identified. That left me pretty astonished. This was the first time in my life when I did not fully know where I came from or who I was. After learning this, I was taken aback. I realized that I didn't know a good portion of who I was. I started wondering, what other races could I belong to? Although I sympathized with many of the racial struggles that I learned about in school, it wasn't until after these interviews that I started to internalize the struggle a lot more. Because honestly, I could belong to those oppressed groups. I have been afraid to let others know this part of me because of the searing pain that I experienced whenever I tried to embrace my Latino side. People would say, "Gringo, trying to be something that is not," or, "What the hell are you doing? You're not one of us," whenever I tried to engage in my culture, whenever I claimed to be Latino. Such interactions made me shy away from explicitly engaging in my Latino side and the culture that I love so much. If this is what happened when I know for a fact that I belong to that race, how much worse would it be when I didn't know officially if I did or not? I am done feeling that I can't embrace the side of me that is unknown, especially when it plays such an important role in how I view myself and the world around me. To those in my past who have said such things, to those who have pushed me down and denied me a piece of who I am, to those who have judged me for my phenotype, I would like to ask you this. Why can't you just understand, my friend, my brother, that I am fighting with you in the trenches against racial hate and inequality? We are dreaming the same dream. We dream of a world in which people are not judged on their appearance, but rather are seen for who they are and are evaluated solely on the merit of their actions. Why, brother, why do you segregate me? Why do you throw me to the curb and not embrace me into your arms? Why can't I just say who I am? Why is that not good enough for you? Our past is full of sorrows, and we have overcome much to come to where we are today. But you do not recognize the role my ancestors have played in such triumph, and the way we have and we continue to overcome adversity. You see me as the enemy despite how hard I have worked for our cause, our dream. You see white and you think aggressor. You see white and you think villain. You look at me and you see me as white and you put these titles onto me. Why must I be lumped in with the racist, whom I despise? Why must I hold the burdens for something that my ancestors have or have not done? Why must the sins of the father be visited upon the son? I acknowledge that the people from my line may have been oppressors, but it is just as important to recognize that my ancestors have also been those who have been oppressed. Again, why must the sins of the past that I share not in plague me, especially when I have tried so hard to fight against it? My friend, my brother, let's dream our dream, let's share our dream, and let's make our dream a reality. You and I working together, working hard. You and I are as one. Our weapons are patience, love, and tolerance. Let's begin the world anew. Let's work together to tear down these barriers that separate us. Let's be all of who we are without judgment. Let's be all of who we are without pain. Let's just be all of who we are. All of who we are.
Thank you very much to Guadalupe Triana, Tony Zamora, Jasmine Grays, Raymond Fenton, Camille Christie, and David Jenkins for sharing their race monologues with us. I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
We'll flip like a local rock track on some beats, rhymes, and life.
What up, y'all?
Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to our February episode of APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta, and part of our features from the Ray Warren Multicultural Symposium at Lewis and Clark College includes my interview with keynote speaker Baratunde Thurston. Baratunde Thurston was the director of digital at the satirical newspaper The Onion and is a speaker and writer on issues concerning race. He is the author of How to Be Black, a memoir on race and growing up in the nation's capital. Baratunde was given this Nigerian name by his so-called hippie mother. The name means one who is chosen and seemed fitting after she had miscarried 9 times before. Besides his name, his upbringing included attending Sidwell Friends School, the prestigious institution which currently hosts the Obama Girls, and attending Ankobia, a pro-African heritage program for black youth. At the same time, Baratunde experienced living in a pre-gentrified neighborhood in Washington, D.C. These experiences and interviews with other writers are included in his book, How to Be Black. The cover is plain, the title is in giant block letters, and can be seen from several yards away. He often challenges readers to read the book in public and force people to glance or stare, and perhaps open up a dialogue on race. I myself read this book while commuting on TriMet. Baratunde and I began our discussion when I inquired about his thoughts on, quote, hipster racism, which manifests in ways such as, oh, I can say this offensive remark because I'm not really racist.
Yeah. So people say that in their comfortable environments. And that there's an assertion of privilege and trust in statements like that. It comes up in comedy some too. You have people doing like really racist material, very aggressive and edgy material and saying, I can do this because it's comedy. Therefore, it's okay to say whatever I want. And you just haven't paid your dues to be able to assert that level of freedom.
What are the dues?
I don't know, living somewhere, getting beat up, understanding, having friends from, listening. We can't all actually walk in everyone else's shoes. That's labor intensive. That's an unreasonable request and expectation. But there's a shortcut. You know, people are skipping over a lot of levels. It's like a video game. And everybody just wants to go straight to the boss level, right? And just take on the boss at the end. He's like, no, you can't get to that part. You got to go find the key. You got to talk to save the princess. You got to like fall in the pit a couple of times and lose your life like three times and then go look up the code on the internet. Like, you don't just skip to the end. You don't just get a college degree. You got to like learn how to read first. So I think there's a lot of people who've been skipping the elementary phases of sort of the language of race and certainly the flippant treatment of racism assumes a certain intimate relationship. It's the language and a relationship. So in the relationship context, it's like the first date you want to have sex. Like immediately. Like it's like, hi, we're banging. Like, no, you don't, even in these loose times with the youth, you know, and whatever they're doing, I read about stuff on Tumblr. That's too much, right? You gotta at least buy a beer. You know what I'm saying? You gotta put something, you gotta invest something. And you don't just get to collect with no investment of a great conversation, of, you know, put some effort into the way you dress, of spend some money, of listen a little bit. So that's a bit rough. So people got to go to school a little bit more. And that's, and I think, the frustration with the, like, oh, I can just say this because, you know, it's ironic. It's like, no, you're really doing a disservice to the level of pain involved in this whole thing. And it is not merely around for your rhetorical amusement. There's actual outcomes and lives and quality of life and health in the balance. And it is disrespectful to ignore all that.
You had mentioned on several occasions that everybody needs a black friend. Every white person needs a black friend. Maybe you mean everybody, but I'm not sure if you mean you need one or you need at least one or a group. But I kind of wanted to challenge you on that because mm-hmm. I understand why you need that cultural liaison. But what I have found in my experiences is that being the token person in someone else's life means that you represent their worldview, and that's not good. Yeah. That's dangerous. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, what we really should have is an exchange program, like study abroad, but here. And you could do it even within the city. You don't have to go traveling overseas. You don't have to cross the country. You don't even have to go north to south. But you could just swap people. Like, and you would, it doesn't have to be all white people, because that's a lot of people. And that just gets expensive. And I'm sensitive to budgetary constraints. But if you got some key white people, the influencers that they hold sway over their peers, and you just yank them out of their world and throw them elsewhere. Throw them in the hood, throw them in another country, throw them around poor people if they're rich, like just break it up a little bit and let them feel it. Then they'll come back and they'll be like, oh, I get it now. And so it's not, I don't think everybody needs a black friend unless there's some kind of subsidy going on. And that's a jobs program for black friendship. And you can kind of apply to be a black friend. And I could do that. I've kind of done it for a while. But I'd want some serious pay at this point because I'm so good. So yeah, the idea of putting that burden on one person, and that being the person of color, the black person, is a bit much. I agree with you on that. I just want white people to do it now. I just want them to do everything now. I want them to pick up. I want them to be like, racism's terrible. We must fight it. I want straight people to be like, yo, homophobia is terrible. We must, like, just everybody just switch roles. And give the folks, give the oppressed people a break and just let them chill for a minute. Maybe go to Club Med or something and just have like a great hoedown. Something approaching that is a level of like radical experimentation that would be a lot of fun to imagine and try to get at in some more practical ways. Putting it all on the black friend, that's probably too much.
A little bit. Speaking of switching roles and putting too much responsibility on the black friend, mm-hmm. We have this president who's been reelected.
Yes, he has.
And I remember when he was campaigning or back when he was senator that there was a lot of flack that he's not really African-American. He's not really black. He's not black enough. He's not this or that or the other. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, he gets flack for being it. So I was wondering if you had any commentary on that.
Yeah, it's an impossible position to be in. And America is dumb from time to time and overly demanding and inconsistent. So there's probably a good diagram of this. There's the not black enough versus too black. And then there's who's saying it, black people versus non-black people. And so in the black people saying he's not black enough, that was early on, and that was from political competition. That was from, you know, old civil rights leaders, idiots, former mayor of Atlanta, ambassador, civil rights hero, just destroying his legacy by saying things like Bill Clinton is as black as Barack Obama. he looks like an idiot now. And I hope history records that as well. So from a black person to him, that's supposed to be a negative. And it's a diss. It's like, oh, you're not really one of us. And you're not, people, oh, he's not really descended from slaves. So he doesn't have slave blood in him. So he's not real black. And I was like, oh, okay, that's just exhausting and stupid. And people aren't really saying that anymore, thank God. But it was really exhausting for that year. Like, mm-hmm. when the believability of his substantial campaign had yet to be accepted, they're just like, oh, Hawaii's not, no, there's no black people in Hawaii. It's just a terrible banner to wave, like the no we can't. Given that his campaign was all like yes we can, it was exceptionally sad. Then you have white people who, when they say it, they are either trying to drive a wedge or they're being complimentary. And like, oh, he's not really black, look at his Harvard degree, he's not one of them, he's one of the good ones, look how articulate and accomplished. And so the backhanded compliment is itself, you know, diss and disrespectful and silly. And then, you know, so that was before. And generally, as he rose to prominence, the comments were that he wasn't really that black. But then it was this really quick switch. And the Reverend Wright moment just, like, brought it out of the woodwork. Now, not only was he super-duper black, he was, like, he's actually Kenyan. He's African and a Muslim and, like, a terrorist. And he's so black, he hates America. This non-slave descendant, right, is just totally inconsistent with the other meme that was running. It's like he's just bitter about all the wrongs that America may probably didn't do. America's never done wrong because America doesn't apologize. But let's hypothetically say America may have done some unkind things to his non-ancestors. He's really pissed about that and palled around with terrorists.
I mean, this is a politician, so people are going to find anything and everything to pick on him and to make ridiculous comments. But it was representing a whole.
Yeah, and I think what was difficult and to his governing is that the level of insanity at the edge prevented some reasonable discussion in the middle. So when the president does things that are not fun to watch, you know, whether it's like drone things or civil liberties abuses, it's cool to be critical of that. But then like those crazy right-wing people are like, he's a monkey. And you're like, okay, well, you call him a monkey. I'm going to defend him now. Like, you've left no reasonable space for actual discussion because you went straight to racism. And that hyper-extended reaction is, you know, there's just so much undealt with rage that you just see bubbling up and flashing and lashing out at this. Like, Obama's become this lightning rod for all these grievances that are economically based. And there's no fact in it. That's just the impression that they have because things aren't going great and it must be a zero-sum world. He's black now, super black guy, and he's just handing out federal cash to black people. I saw this comment last week on someone I ended up having to block on Facebook. He had been a troll for a long time. So I clicked through to see his profile because he had said something really horrible about Hurricane Sandy and the response, and he displayed a lack of compassion, which I thought was like unacceptable. And I went through his page and I found more things like that from him and his other friends, and people like, oh, you know, who doesn't keep more than 2 days worth of food in their house? They're probably just spending it all on their welfare checks Obama gave them. Wow. There's a dark, dark, dark side to this country that often comes out on the internet.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KABU. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is an interview with Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, an insightful and hilarious memoir on Black America. The book features conversations with various writers and their experiences with race. In the second half of this interview, we continued our discussion regarding the failed attempt at dialogues on race, such as terms like colorblind and post-racial.
Well, talking about being too black or not black enough, or there's a lot of food-related terms that people have. In my community, they use the term coconut, meaning you're brown on the outside, you're white on the inside.
Yeah, you got coconut. Eggs,
yeah, because we're a tropical people. Bananas. So I think, so in your community, they use the term Oreo. And so talk about judging identity. Do we have the right to do that? Or how do we do that? And why do we do that?
Well, we do it out of a self-preservation sort of defense mechanism of protect the tribe, the homeland. Like if you're a part of a persecuted group, you can't really. Touré writes about this very well in his book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? He talks about how we were so on the defense for so long We couldn't afford to let people express themselves in a different way because we had to like stay together. And that meant culturally stay together, and that meant this is black, we can't trust you otherwise. Like, could be one of them. It's not helpful. And it's, you know, very illegitimate. Like, Clarence Thomas isn't any less black. He's wrong. You know, like, I don't think Herman Cain isn't black. I think he's an idiot. And when you know, Cornel West did it the other way around to Obama, he, like, you know, got really ugly in the past 2 years with his criticism. And he basically said, this guy's not black. And he said, oh, he's, you know, he's getting come from these white parents that hangs around Jews all the time. He got really petty. And no, Obama's still black. He just does something you disagree with. Like, you can just be wrong. It doesn't have to be a betrayal of your race that dilutes your membership in that race. Like, yeah, I think the policies of, like, Michael Steele as running the Republican Party, not that great for black people. Doesn't make him less black. We just need to separate concentration of blackness within a soul versus, like, what the impact of their actions are.
Related to this, these movements like post-racial and colorblind. So okay, expand on that. On that grunt.
Yeah, no, that's as articulate as I can be about something that is about as meaningful as blah. So whenever somebody says post-racial, you just translate that into and then you're like, what was that? Exactly. I didn't say anything. That's a quaint idea. As I have a whole chapter about it. And I interviewed people about it, and everybody had the same response, which is, "Is," and you know, thankfully the rhetoric around it is much diminished. There was a study came out about a month ago, within the past month, I should say, from AP, I think, it tested racial attitudes in the U.S. since you know the president's first election. So yeah, post-racial, colorblind, not helpful, not useful, not you know, there's no learning there. There's a burying one's head in the sand instead of hoping problems go away. And there's damage in doing it in that we have problems in the world and in this country, certainly, that are heavily related to the race of the people who are suffering from these problems. And if we act like, well, race just doesn't exist, then we're missing a likely key factor in what separates, you know, positive outcomes for people in a country that's supposed to be able to provide for all its people. So that's the harm that comes from aspiring to post-racialness and certainly declaring it well before we're anywhere.
And especially with this multicultural symposium, we're talking about being the spokespeople of talking about minorities and communities, mm-hmm. race, ethnicity, and culture. And I always wonder who really has the right to do that, because it ends up being a lot of power over people who either cannot or won't speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, I had to figure out how I was articulating this, but I think I have something like, what do you have to say about being a spokesperson on behalf of a community? Yeah. Do we have the right to represent this community? Who has the right to define a community and advocate for a community?
Well, if you are duly elected, you actually have the right, right? If there have been ballots and some kind of democratic process. Or if you just have a lot of force and you threaten people with guns and stuff, then I guess you have the right of force to represent yourself. I am in neither of those positions and claim no explicit representation. I guess I speak for all humans. If the aliens come, I would volunteer to go and like negotiate on behalf, because I feel like I got a pretty good grip on like what it means to be a person, biologically and emotionally and stuff. So if it happens, you guys can call me up. I will serve. But in terms of speaking for black people or for whatever people, the folks who step forward just get it. They just get the jobs to do it, like in the media, et cetera. Or there is a...
Oh, writing a book about how to be black.
Yeah, that's different, though. That's different. I think that, I mean, there's obviously a limit to what one person can see, interpret, and represent. Like, you have to have a level of access. You have to have a level of, like, interest. And it's just physically impossible to represent everybody through one person. It's convenient to have a person to go to for the establishment of any kind, for any institution. You'd be like, oh, it's Martin Luther King. That's the dude. He didn't represent all black people. There were a ton of black people who thought he was a troublemaker. And she just shut up. leave it alone. Let these white folks do their thing. We're going to do our thing over here. And, you know, you go through some of the more prominent media figures over the decades, usually dudes. What is fascinating now to me is that, I mean, if you really want to, like, speak for people and be like, yeah, I'm representing this whole thing, you got to go and listen to them and kind of gain their trust so that they're like, yeah, this dude speaks for us. You certainly, and I speak for me, and I speak very loudly, and I think I speak for people who have been like me with an implicit understanding, like, yeah, we had a life kind of like that. That dude, like, there's not a lot of people protesting the things I'm saying because I'm, like, vastly misrepresenting or under, misrepresenting is the word I was looking for. But what I was really getting at is the idea of funneling experience through single points of expression, i.e. a spokesperson, is less necessary these days because everybody's got their own megaphones and has got their own broadcasting facilities in their hands. They got their phones, they got computers, and not every single person, but most, by and large, and more than ever in history. So there's another interesting opportunity to listen to what those folks are saying and also just let those folks speak for themselves, whoever they are. And instead of being like, oh yeah, we think black people think what that person on cable news says, like, oh, you just go see what black people are saying because they're talking in a very discoverable medium known as the internet, partially. And I think that's useful. There's also, on the politics side of things, there is a way to structure that leadership such that it is in tune with the grassroots more and actually, like, goes community by community and block by, like, listens and organizes. That's a lot of work that a lot of people don't want to do. Shortcuts, again, we love them. The country rewards shortcuts, and that makes some sense economically, not always politically. So those are my thoughts on spokespersonness. And just for the record, I'm not trying to be a spokesperson for Black America. I'll be a spokesperson for Earth. It's a bigger game.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Little bit more responsible.
Set your sights higher.
Thank you so much, Baritunda Thurston, for chatting with me.
Thank you very much for being chattable unto.
That was Baritunde Thurston, the comedic author of the memoir, How to Be Black. Baritunde Thurston was the keynote speaker at the annual Ray Warren Multicultural Symposium at Lewis and Clark College last November, when this interview was recorded. You can follow Baritunde on Facebook and Twitter and learn more about the annual symposium at the Lewis and Clark College website. I'm Sari Gametha, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The sound against the shores of the suicide capital. Bust the magical dust grammatically, just the satellite. What makes Seattle tight? The fruits have been ripe.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Andrew Yeh. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Marilina Lin. Marilina is assistant professor at Arizona State University and an expert in understanding how blogs and social media influence politics, especially in non-Western contexts. Marilina, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've heard reports of how in the Egyptian Revolution of 2011, social media like Facebook and Twitter were used to organize protests at the last minute. Could you complete the picture for us?
Well, I would argue it's not really last-minute organizing. In fact, this all digital activism in Middle East could be traced back as early as 98, Indonesia, Tunisia, 99, 2000s. Egypt was, in particular, very vibrant. They had one of the most vibrant blogosphere back in 2007 to 2000. Well, so they had been going on for some time. Tunisia online activism started 10 years before they had a revolt in January 2011. What was happening before December 2010 was that not that there was no activism, there was actually many activism online and offline, but they were not really well connected. So online activism, for example, focused more on internet censorship. At the same time, most people in the rural area, poor area, they didn't use internet. They didn't care about internet censorship. When they protested, it's protested unemployment, torture, right? It's something more tangible. What was happened in December was the result of activism for years that finally get to understand on how to frame the particular self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi into a language and a story that resonated with entire society. Before Mohamed Bouazizi, there were 9 self-immolation within 6 months. People burned themselves, nobody knew, right?
I see.
So he wasn't the first. I think in the West, we thought it was the first. It was not the first. But everybody else were framed as if they were poor street vendors, burned themselves because they were hungry. Mohamed Bouazizi never finished high school. He was a poor street vendor. But activists in Sidi Bouzid framed that particular moment. The first story that went out, it was an unemployed university graduate was slapped by a police woman. So that's like the whole story around that self-immolation. Reframe the struggle of the poor become a struggle for freedom and dignity, which is a totally different narrative for the first time that resonated well with middle-class, unemployed university graduates in Tunis, in richer, better part of Tunisia, and most people who are online. Also, the self-immolation of Bouazizi was the first one that was captured on camera. That's really made a big difference. The visual, dramatic visualization of suffering, right? This is symbolic, iconic, epic. That made it online. Otherwise, you didn't have picture. Didn't happen, right, on Facebook. Mm-hmm. You had a cute cat, but you don't show it. Nobody believe you, right? So that's an interesting story. It's not so much about this is the first and social media made it big, but I think the work behind the scene.
So the work behind the scenes, was that really trying to develop the right way to frame things?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Right way to frame. And if you look at all social media activism, I would say over 99% of social media activism fail. Mm-hmm. Only less than 1% were successful. And all of these cases is actually something to do with framing, symbolization, where they have symbol, story that are simple that most people could understand within such a short time. You know, this social media is basically, I use the term light package. If it is light, you don't really have to spend 24 hours to understand what it is. If it is kind of headline appetite, you know, it's headline dramatic, and then you understand what this is all about by reading 140 characters, right? And trailer is not the whole movie, but it's a trailer. So if you fit that kind of criteria, your story of activism, it's more likely that people will pay attention to it.
For some underrepresented minorities, blogs are maybe one of the few ways that they can actually get their voice out there. How do they make themselves more relevant?
For minorities or marginalized community, the best way is to build network, really, because individually you're going to cross by powerful, right? You have powerful actors, powerful institutions that are also dominant online. But networks, when you build network and create moments, basically moments with the right framing, engage with the participatory culture, and you cannot do it overnight, but you could build. And social media is good to grow your network, to cultivate your network. And activism is all about growing your network, perpetuating narrative stories of your cause, and seize opportunities. One, you have a moment and then take it, right? You might fail, but you keep building. But your network is not died even when the momentum perhaps fades. I think that's what happened in Egypt. That's what happened in Tunisia. And I know Hispanic Coalition, for example, in the U.S., keep building the election show, right? They made their name. Hey, we matter in this country.
Right.
I think that's a good sign.
What do you see as some of the emerging trends in social media?
One of my slides show that how different platform is very social media platform choice reflect different kind of demographic. Interestingly, Pinterest, for example, 79% of the Pinterest users are white, 70% of them are women, right? Twitter is predominantly Hispanic and African American, for example. Foursquare is predominantly Asian. More likely to be on Foursquare, twice as much. So I think this is interesting that technological design and feature of social media seemingly to be tailored to certain group. I don't think it was intentional at first, but I see that the marketing, everything has become more targeting, right? Consumer targeting, profile-based kind of practices in innovation has becoming a new thing right now. Mostly, I think they work under marketing logic because they think they could, if we do it certain way, they would attract certain demographic. But I guess it also has implication on the way different social groups interact online. Apparently, homophily, which is people tend to communicate with people who are more similar to them, has become more prominent online as well.
Marilina, what are you working on next?
I still have research and or on social media activism for female movement in Muslim countries. Saturday, I will present on my work on underwear movement. This is underwear movement. This is actually Saudi movement. Finally successful. They were successful in forcing the government to let women work at the underwear stores that were banned for some time. It was male only. It is underwear, but it is a symbol of a struggle for women's rights, really.
This is selling men's underwear or women's underwear?
Women's underwear. Basically, everybody underwear.
Anybody.
Right. But the story was that before early this year, in Saudi, women were banned from workforce except for medical and education industry. And for around three, four years, her activism online, on Facebook mostly, to force the government to ban men from selling underwear, because it's kind of awkward. It's almost embarrassing for women. This is a possibly this is symbolize something larger, right? Mm-hmm. That women had no right even over buying their own underwear. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good move. They were successful in that, and I continue working on trying to understand not only social media but women activism in general. Global slut walk, for example, how women all over the world rise to together to challenge this all sexual harassment practices. And I think it's interesting to see in Middle East how women do that together. It will keep me busy for some time, yeah.
So Miralina, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you too. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So Professor Miralina Lim is assistant professor at Arizona State University, specializing in information and communication studies. A shout out to our friends at Lewis and Clark College, who invited Professor Lim to Portland for the Ray Ward Multicultural Symposium. I'm Andrew Ye for APA Compass.
Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. Thanks very much to all of our guests today. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of every month and is collectively produced by Luann Algoso, Kushlani D'Souza, Tuvan Huang, Sarika Mehta, Anna Preble, Tony Tabora Roberts, Liz Rogers, Brian Yarn, and Andrew Yeh. You can download segments of this and other shows at our website, kboo.fm/APA Compass.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock in the a.m. and time for Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, Greg Palast makes the case that Aaron Swartz died for Piers Morgan's sins. Also, more revelations on the independent investigation into the Canadian church and government participation in genocide of Indigenous children, and a look at Iranian revolutionary art. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are joined again by BBC reporter and best-selling author, most recently of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, Greg Palast. He joins us from New York City. Greg, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Glad to be with you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And I want to talk to you about, well, two folks, Aaron Swartz, a young computer genius who recently killed himself rather than face, I don't know, 30, 40 years for what, liberating information. And then, on the other hand, you sort of talk about what happened to Piers Morgan for breaking the law, committing all kinds of felonies, profiting from it. And then becoming, I guess, sort of a refugee on CNN in the United States. You want to sort of remind people, let's start by reminding people who Aaron Swartz is and maybe unfold this tale a little bit.
First of all, it's